I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. For anyone listening to NPR over the past 3 years, the name Kelly McEvers will be familiar. She was a correspondent in the turbulent Middle East in the time of the Arab uprisings. Colleagues and friends were being kidnapped. Some were getting killed. But still, she went toward the story. At the same time, she started asking herself and others, why? Why do otherwise intelligent people risk their lives when they don't have to? In collaboration with Jay Allison and Transom.org, Kelly produced a radio documentary, A Bad Year, A War Correspondent's Dilemma. Jay Allison joins us in our Woods Hole studio. Good morning, Jay.
Hey, Mindy.
And Kelly McEvers joins us from our East Ham studio. Good morning, Kelly.
Hi there.
So I want to start by playing the first minute or so of the documentary. And first, we're going to hear Jay, followed by Kelly, recording in a car.
2012 was one of the deadliest years on record for journalists. The Arab uprisings and now the conflict in Syria have claimed the lives of dozens of reporters. And yet they still go back into conflict.
Yeah, right. So this is one of those moments where you're like speeding down the road in a car with dudes with guns. You have no idea where you're going. And part of you thinks it's a really good idea.
We're way outside of any town or village, just over the border. With three guys who have AK-47s. They are all, you know, wearing green khaki-type jackets and, you know, headscarves tied around their hair. They've got beards. They're psyched. You know, they're clearly, like, pumped with adrenaline. Can't stop thinking, like, why am I doing this? I know the answers, and none of them are good. I'm doing this because other people did it, and I felt competitive. I'm doing this because I've been trying to get some kind of access for like 2 weeks, and now that I finally got it, I did it. I'm also worried that if I make it out, that's like one more step toward the abyss. Every time you make it out okay, that's like further down the road you go, thinking that you're always going to make it out okay.
Okay, Kelly, tell us a little bit more about that piece of tape. Where were you going and what led up to your questioning into your recorder why you're putting yourself at risk to cover the story?
We just crossed over from Lebanon into Syria. It was not a legal crossing. We had worked with some smugglers to take us from the Lebanese side over to the Syrian side. And we had teamed up with some guys who at the time were some of the earliest brigades of the so-called Free Syrian Army. These are the rebels that are fighting to bring down the Syrian regime. And, you know, we were driving around in a car that's windows had all been shot out. And these guys, like I said in the tape, were armed. They were showing us where, you know, sort of government positions were along the road. And we were, you know, showing us some secret locations for the rebel units themselves. The reason I was talking into my telephone, I was using my phone as a microphone at that time because we didn't want to bring a lot of kit with us because we were sort of sneaking around, was because, you know, a few months earlier I had talked to Jay and we had talked about, you know, maybe I should start recording my thoughts while I was in the field. Maybe I should try, if I could, at certain moments of doing my job to sort of step back and reflect a little bit. And that's what I was doing. I was just kind of trying to get as much perspective as I could on the moment. Just think about what I was doing and what it meant.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jane, I got to ask you this now. You asked Kelly to maybe step back and do that. Did you know at that time that she was thinking about why am I doing this and maybe I want to get out?
Well, Kelly came here to Woods Hole. You know, we have the Transom Story Workshop and she came and talked to the students. And she and I were talking too. She wanted to talk about how to get some more narrative in her stories or just different things to try, get some editorial feedback on the work she does for NPR in her daily reporting, which is great, by the way.
Yeah.
And she and I were talking about it. And then she started talking about this, all these deep questions about whether, you know, what decision a person makes when they're in a very dangerous job and with a family and, you know, wanting to and getting older and all these things that were shadows in her mind at that point. And I said, why don't we do a piece about that maybe, you know, and because that sounds like an actual narrative.
Yeah,
and
sure does.
And then And we talked about the idea of starting to use her tape recorder as a diary and just see what happened. We weren't sure, but I think, Kelly, you can tell me if this is right, but at the moment we embarked on it, I think you said something like, you know, if I do this, if I follow all the way through this, it's, you know, it's going to have a huge impact on whether or not I keep doing this job.
Is that right, Kelly? Did we lose Kelly? Kelly, are you there?
Kelly McEvers.
Oh, okay. We'll get back on the line. While we're waiting to get Kelly back on the line, why don't you, Jay, tell us about transom.org? We mentioned that, but some people who may not know what transom.org is.
It's a website that we started here in Woods Hole now maybe 13 years ago. It was the first website ever to win a Peabody Award for broadcasting. The idea is that it helps give you the tools to tell your own story, particularly in public broadcasting. And so we have great guests who come and talk about the mission and purpose of this line of work in journalism and storytelling, and then also all the tools you need to tell your story. So we introduce new voices and try to get new people into public broadcasting and keep it open to the public, I mean, is the main idea. But we also have a secondary mission, which is to encourage people who've been around and are working professionals to try new things or to go to new places or take a risk and give them a context where that risk is welcomed and encouraged. And then often I'll work with people like that or other members of our Transom team who would be familiar to CAI listeners, Vicki Merrick and Sydney Lewis and Samantha Brown.
So it's really all about storytelling, whether you're beginning that career or as in this case with Kelly's diary, this is a little bit different than the reporting that she was doing for NPR.
Yeah, generally. I mean, the idea is to take whatever is most challenging to a person and say, you know what, if that's what's scaring you or if that's what you think you wouldn't do otherwise, then let us help you try to do that.
All right. We've got Kelly back now. Kelly, so talk a little bit about recording these diaries and you know, where that question first started. Did the question of why am I here, why am I doing this start before you started to think about recording these diaries? Let's get Kelly on the phone rather than the ISDN line, and Jay and I will chat until we get Kelly back. All right. So,
what do you want to talk about, Mindy?
I want to talk about this diary, this documentary that you guys put together. So it's a bad year, a war correspondent's dilemma.
Diary of a bad year.
Yeah, diary of a bad year. So tell us, when Kelly came back with all of this tape, the process of putting this together.
Well, she didn't so much come back as this took almost 2 years to do. When we finished, and we would just check in periodically, and she would send me emails with titles like "Brain Dump," and she would just pour out everything she was thinking and feeling, and then send clips and send little diary excerpts, kind of like that one in the back of the pickup truck there, but others that were more maybe quiet late at night, sitting by herself or walking down a street. And so we would and a lot of them she was emotional that we and even though they framed a context for what we were going to be talking about, this decision of whether to stick with this work, you couldn't use them all in the documentary because Kelly would be crying all the time. So,
it's a pretty powerful stuff there, though. I mean, in the documentary, there's some very powerful moments, and this you really sense her struggle.
Yeah, well, she's she took on the task of reporting on her own life and reporting on her own transition, and to do so, she went to talk to other war correspondents. So it's also a remarkable portrait of remarkable reporters as she moves through it. You know, Paul Wood, Sebastian Younger, John Lee Anderson, Christiane Amanpour, and Kelly talks to them all and talks about they're confronting this decision to stay in the field or stop and change course.
All right. So let's
have Kelly back.
Oh, yay. Technology, right? So, Kelly, tell us about where the questions first started to arise of why am I here? Was this before you started recording the diaries or once you started recording?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, the moment I started questioning things actually was the moment that I started getting really involved in covering the Arab Spring. So it was kind of this kind of parallel trajectory, the way the two things happened. It was early 2011, and I was actually stationed in Baghdad at the time, and everybody else that I knew was covering the Arab uprisings. And, you know, Cairo was crazy with protests. There was fighting in Libya as rebels tried to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Bahrain was, you know, erupting in protests. Yemen, everybody, everywhere, all over the region. And I was sitting in Baghdad watching it on TV, and I really wanted to cover the story. And it was there that I heard about the deaths of Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros, two fabulous photographers, wonderful human beings. Chris was a friend of mine. And there was just this day sitting in my office when things actually started moving in slow motion. Like I would move my hand sort of in front of my face, and it felt like it was heavy or weighted or something. I mean, it was just the strangest physical reaction to trauma, and it was completely unfamiliar to me. I had no idea what was going on, and I really felt like I was falling apart. And you know, I called this psychotherapist who NPR had on retainer at the time. His name is Mark Brain, and we have him in the piece, and he talks me through what's going on. I mean, he talks to me about how this is, you know, this is basically a pretty textbook reaction to trauma when you're traumatized by something, and you can be traumatized by something from far away. But the thing was, it wasn't just that. What happened at that moment was it threw all of what I do into question. I thought, why did Tim and Chris, why did they do this? Why do I do this? What is wrong with us? Why do we choose this profession? And that was really the beginning. That's right. How it all started.
Well, and you know, you said something in that clip that we played at the top where you say, you know, making it out. Every time you make it out, you know, you have the sense of security that I'm going to make it out again. And I think reporters in general, you sort of feel like you're there for the story, but you're sort of separate. And maybe this like false sense of security when you're just as vulnerable as anybody else there. But do you think that the deaths of Tim and Chris like really drove that home for you? Because that was such a shock.
It was, and there were more after them. Yeah. You know, 2012 was this really bad year, and that's why we called the piece Diary of a Bad Year. We lost some of the greats, you know, Anthony Shadid of the New York Times, Marie Colvin of the Times of London. But there is this sense, you know, everybody talks about it, that somehow the bullets go around you, you know, that you have this, because you have this sense of purpose, because you have this mission, that you won't get hurt. And yeah, every time you go in, you get more and more, and make it out, you get more and more secure that's going to happen. And whenever somebody dies, the whole community, the whole tribe goes into sort of upheaval. And we all sit around for a few days and we talk about, wow, I guess that's not true. And then, you know, a week, 2 weeks later, we go back and we do it again. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. We do need to do this job. We need to be there to witness it. I'm just saying maybe we need to talk about it a little bit more, you know, and talk about, I think part of it is, you know, you respond by going back in because you want to kind of avenge those that have been lost and do what, continue the work that they were doing. But I don't know, maybe we should just talk about it a little bit more about what it means to want to go in and what are you thinking when you go in? Why are you doing it? Sebastian Younger, one of the people we interviewed in the piece, says, you know, you need to think really hard about why you're doing this. Are you doing this for the story or are you doing this for yourself?
Right. Yeah, good question. Let's play another clip from the documentary.
What? It's coming this way? Okay. Open. We should get in it. Okay, we're back in a house. Okay, now we're hiding. Ah! Jesus Christ.
Oh my God.
They're shooting in the house. So, I mean, we're basically trapped in a kind of safe house right now. They are firing tear gas canisters at very close range. So if it hits a person, it can injure them. And the tear gas is horrible. it's one of those days, you know, where across the Arab world, people are getting tear gassed and beaten, and you, part of you is like feeling what they feel and knowing what they know is really important to be able to tell the story. But is it really worth it? I don't know.
So, Kelly, give us a bit of behind the scenes of reporting in conflict areas for NPR. What kind of security precautions do you take, and what are some of the NPR policies designed to make your job safer?
We take it really seriously. Every time, for instance, I would go into Syria, you know, into these rebel-controlled areas of the country where we're basically, you know, sneaking over borders, it's, you know, weeks of conversations. We go in with a security advisor, always. We're always accompanied by a security advisor. These are usually ex-British Special Forces folks who now work for the media. They're trained medics. You know, if you get lost, they can use their GPS and get you out of anywhere. They're really good at, so quote-unquote, extractions. So, you know, I mean, we're always thinking about it, and there's a lot of planning that goes into it. And I think that's something that's different than, you know, war reporting even, say, 10, 15 years ago. I think news organizations have thought pretty hard about how to better protect their people. I mean, I think, you know, they're also protecting themselves, right? They need to make sure they've ticked off all the boxes and said that they've done the right things. And there's only so much a security advisor can do. I mean, if you're in a bad area, you're in a bad area, and the risks are still there.
Like this clip we just heard, you know, you're ducking into this house, they're shooting into the house. I don't know that I would be calm enough to do the reporting that you do. I mean, I just can't even imagine being in that kind of a situation to be calm like that, even though, you know, you have people shooting at you.
I mean, we interviewed a couple of, you know, researchers, scientists for this piece as well, and I think what they say, and this is, there's probably some truth to it, is there's a certain kind of person that's going to do this kind of work. Somebody who, you know, I mean, there's different theories, right? One of them is that we have, you know, people who choose these types of jobs or more adventurous types of jobs might have enhanced levels of a neurotransmitter called dopamine. And because of that, when you're in a situation where you're under a lot of stress, it's not that you're calm, but you see things very clearly. You can think very clearly. And, you know, increased adrenaline really helps you do that as well. I mean, you see colors, things are brighter, you know, you notice details in a way that you never would before. I will have that particular clip, they were not shooting live ammunition. That was tear gas canisters. They're about the size of a half of a baguette or something, shooting it into this house where we were. But it was like a plywood sort of shack, and so when they would shoot it at such close range, it would break through the wood, and at really close range, I mean, it has been known to kill people, but it wasn't. It was one of those days where you're like, you know, I asked myself, was it worth it? And I can honestly say, listening back, I know it sounds crazy, yes, it was worth it to be there to tell that story. That was a day, I was in Bahrain, that was a day when the government said, you know, we're making amends, we're trying to move forward, we don't want to hurt our people, we want them to be able to protest freely. And here we were, you know, in this remote village, you know, hiding out in a house where people were getting chased down and attacked with these tear gas canisters. So we were able to say to the world, hang on, the government's lying. You know, so I mean, that was a point where it was like the physical risk was basically getting tear gassed. You know, if you kept your head down, you probably weren't going to get hurt. It was worth telling the story.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the NPR psychiatrist who you talked to, that NPR keeps on staff. Do reporters generally make use of this service, or is the culture of journalists, particularly those covering war or conflict, such that people kind of shrug off the emotional impacts?
In our case in particular, I don't know, because it's all confidential.
Right, right.
It should be. And he's somebody we have on, he's on staff, he's somebody we have on a retainer, but he's somebody we can call up at any time. I mean, it is interesting. I didn't actually know that, you know, in the beginning. Like, no one, it's not like they put out a memo and say that. It was something I kind of had to hear from word of mouth. That is changing, too, and I think my piece, I think, is helping that. But, yeah, the culture is definitely not one of, you know, seeking therapy. You know, it is a culture of toughing it out. And just trying to get through it on your own. I mean, I think there's a couple of reasons for that, right? You know, it was a very kind of macho world, the world of war correspondents. And also, you know, it's like, how can you sit and complain about your own problems when the people you're covering are going through far worse, mm-hmm. you know, far worse than you could ever even imagine. You know, people, millions of people who've been driven from their homes, people who are dying, you know, in chemical weapon attacks, you know, people who are being bombed when they're waiting in line for bread. How could mm-hmm. you possibly think that your problems are worth, even worth talking about? I mean, mm-hmm. I think that's really been the culture of the war correspondents as well. And I put that to one of the people we interviewed in the piece, Dr. Anthony Feinstein, and he said a really interesting thing. He said, that's like saying you're in a hospital room and the guy next to you has cancer and you've got a broken leg and they should only treat the cancer patient but not treat you at all. Mm-hmm. You know, that yes, they should treat him first, but that you need to be treated too because yeah. trauma is real and these things are real. And if you don't get treated, they'll come back.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the radio documentary Diary of a Bad Year, A War Correspondent's Dilemma with Kelly McEvers and Jay Allison. Jay, talk a little bit about the tape that you're going through. I mean, Kelly, I know you mentioned earlier she sent you some emails with clips, and I imagine she came back with a whole lot of tape, and as you mentioned, a lot of it very emotional. And when you hear the document, you hear her struggle. Was it tough kind of deciding which stories to tell and which ones, you know,
well,
to leave out?
The interesting thing about this as a documentary is instead of the usual way is that you have a great deal of material and then you impose some kind of structure on it and maybe you move in time, maybe you move in space, maybe there's scenes, maybe you have flashbacks. This piece ended up being structured as a relentless move forward. I mean, we kept considering, do we mess with the timeline? Do we bring interviewees back? Do we move topically? But it really just marched through Kelly's experience. Finally, that's the way we chose to do it. So lots of stuff would get thrown away if it didn't fit this chronology because the piece is not there isn't it's not a false structure. It is an exact structure that replicates Kelly's genuine quest to mm-hmm. answer these questions. Right. It wasn't about making a radio documentary in right. some fundamental way. It was about she is a reporter and applied her reporting skills to figure out whether she could continue to work in this place. And I think a key question in that is she has a family, a husband, and a little girl, and constantly through this piece, she's trying to wrestle with that responsibility.
Right, exactly.
You know, the mission and purpose of the work, and the mission and purpose of, you know, motherhood and family. And in that sense, there may be those questions of sacrifice, even though Kelly's in a dangerous situation. But I mean, that applies to anybody who may work a dangerous job. Yeah. But any job, in some sense, you're always trying to make that. Figure out what that balance should be
exactly.
and who pays the price.
Right. And again, it depends on the family and the situation. Not everyone comes to the same answer there, which is part of the dilemma.
Yeah.
Kelly, talk about how you approach this. You as you say, you used your reporter skills to try and answer these questions.
Right. So in that first conversation, you know, when I talked to Mark Brain, the psychotherapist, he comforted me, he made me feel better, but I realized that I was facing a much bigger sort of existential dilemma about what I was doing, who I was, and whether it made sense. And so from there, we just, you know, I started to, you know, it was just like calling people up and asking them for advice and kind of keeping track of those conversations as they went through time. And then once, you know, I started working with Jay, we kind of decided that might be the way we'd structure this is just kind of on this quest. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to other, you know, scientists, this Dr. Feinstein I talked about, and other journalists, of course, people, other members of the so-called tribe of war correspondents, people who've done it for a long time, who are still doing it, people who have quit. And I also spoke to, you know, the daughter mm-hmm. of a war correspondent who was killed in El Salvador in the late 80s. And she's, you know, she's my age now, and she's still really upset with mm-hmm. her father, upset with him for choosing this life and upset with him for dying for a story, for not choosing to be with her instead. And it was a very tough conversation, you know. Mm-hmm. She, here, it was like, you know, having my own grown child confronting me mm-hmm. years later had something happen to me, and I had you know, been killed covering a story.
That's Anna Blundy you're talking about, daughter of David Blundy. And she tells you her father's decision to carry on his work as a correspondent in dangerous places made her feel that his job was more important to him than she was. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you're a wife and a mother. And so talk about your reaction hearing that. I mean, she used the word it being fun. And I thought that was interesting because I don't think a lot of people think of journals, war correspondents thinking it's fun. But mm-hmm. as you mentioned, there was that adrenaline. You're getting the story. So there's a kind of that aspect to it.
She said, yeah, it's fun. You admit it. It's fun. You know, don't think it's this big grand mission you're after. You do it because it's fun. I think it's both. It's definitely fun. I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but there is a thrill to it. There's an excitement to it. There's the sense that you are the person telling the most important story in the world at that moment. That is just very exciting. When you make it out of something, right? You know, it's like getting away with something, like when you're a little kid, you know, something you maybe aren't supposed to be doing. I think it's that feeling. It's really hard to explain. You're putting on, you know, like army pants and wearing a headlamp and chomping on, you know, power bars to make it through because you haven't slept for three nights. You know, that feels tough and cool. It's like going on a really difficult hiking trip or something, you know, and I think that's kind of fun. There's a lot of that wrapped up into it, and I think a lot of people who do this job all know that, but we don't necessarily talk about it very much. So it was nice to hear Anna say that in some ways to kind of call us out. I mean, at the time that she was saying those things to me, I was very, very, very strung out. I was, you know, we had just lost Anthony Shadid and Marie Colvin, two wonderful journalists, a couple months before. The community was really upset, and people were still going into Syria. It was very risky. I wasn't sleeping very well, you know, so when she said all that stuff to me, I kind of just crumbled and said, you're right, you know, I'm a terrible person. Later, you know, I thought about it, and I thought, well, hang on a second, you know, I think some of what you're saying has a lot to do with you and your relationship with your father, and the way you felt about him. I am not your father. You know, I'm not the carousing, you know, war correspondent who promises to come home and visit you and doesn't show up because he's out at the bar. Like, I think many of my colleagues in this generation of war correspondents, I think we're different. We have families. I'm not the only one who has a child, and I'm not the only woman either. Most of the people covering Syria right now are women. And, you know, so I think we're a different kind of people. Like, I was, you know, when I was in Beirut, where I was stationed, I made dinner and put my daughter to bed every night, you know. So I think it was important to hear what Anna had to say, but also to sort of differentiate myself and maybe even my generation from her father.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, too, because she was, you know, sort of determined in some of the comments where you asked her if she wished she had a letter from her dad, and she said she did. And you asked her at one point, should I write that letter? She says, no, because you're going to quit.
Yeah, she says, no, you're going to stay home with your daughter.
Yeah, right.
You know, that's really tough.
Yeah.
She had an interesting phrase that stuck with me. I mean, on one hand, it's a little bit sort of self-absorbed and finger-pointy, but on the other hand, is a legit indictment, not just of maybe a war correspondent, but any parent who's obsessed outside the family relationship. She said, he prioritized against me. But I feel like, and that phrase kind of gave me the willies a little bit, but I think anyone in any line of work can think, oh, geez, do I want my grown daughter to speak that way?
Exactly, of course.
Of me later on.
Of me later on, yeah.
Well, throughout the piece, there's this push and pull that you're grappling with whether the risks are worth it. But at the same time, you seem to know in your heart that you will go back despite the risk. There's a bit of tape from this documentary that I want to play about you grappling with this.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right, yeah. So I'm walking down the street with my kid in her stroller. I don't really have time to do this any other way. A couple of days ago, a French journalist was killed, and basically the first journalist to be killed in the Syrian conflict. And then there was a video of what happened that went around the internet of his... I couldn't watch it. Apparently, it showed the attack, showed people putting his already lifeless body into the back of a taxi while his wife, who was there, looked on. This is just, it's just the thought of that, just that you could end up just like some video on YouTube that like some government is going to use as a piece of propaganda is just too deeply disturbing. I cannot get it out of my mind. Yeah, honey, that's an airplane. I cannot get it out of my mind. I'm pretending like I'm talking on the phone right now. I just can't stop thinking about it. This is the scariest thing about this whole thing is that I know I'm gonna have to go. Not because anyone's gonna make me go, but because I'm gonna make myself go. Just really started to ask myself, like, what did I do? You know, what did I do?
Kelly, talk a little bit about that struggle. I mean, it's like you've been telling friends for a long time, I'm going to quit. I'm going to find a way to quit. And yet you can't.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, this is at a really interesting moment in all of this. You know, I'd started asking all these questions and then basically it was right at this time that we had set up shop in Beirut, which is a fabulous city, a great place to live, but right next door is Syria, which when I was covering it before was, you know, one of these Arab uprising stories. What was becoming clear after the death of that journalist, especially on that day, it really hit me that, oh, no, this is a war. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a war, and I have just signed myself and my family up for covering a war. This is different. You know, it's one thing to be in the Middle East, I mean, and covering protests in the streets and these Arab uprisings. It's a completely different thing to be a war correspondent. You know, some people sign up to be war correspondents. Mm-hmm. I never did. Right. I didn't put my hand up and say I'm dying to cover war. I was covering these uprisings, you know, and I was deeply, deeply committed and connected to the Syria story from the beginning. So that was when it was like, oh, no, I've, you know, mm-hmm. the thing that I've signed on to is becoming something else. Yeah. And I'm going to have to stick with it. Yeah. You know, that was what was really going on. And, you know, I probably could have turned away at that point, but as you can hear me saying, I was going to make myself go. I was going to continue covering it because I wanted to do it because I was committed to the story.
We're talking with Kelly McEvers and Jay Allison about the radio documentary Diary of a Bad Year, A War Correspondent's Dilemma. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org.
I should mention, too, that we're if you're interested in this, we're going to play the entire hour documentary at two listening events coming up this week, this Sunday, the 25th, in Woods Hole at the Community Hall, and then the following night, the 26th, Monday, in Wellfleet at Preservation Hall. Kelly and I will be there, and we'll play the piece and take more questions, and those events are free. Get there early.
Because seating is limited, and no reserved seats for this. Kelly, I want to ask you now, looking at what's going on in Syria, we have these alleged chemical weapons attacks. And are you sitting here now thinking, I'm so glad I'm not there? Or are you going, oh, my God, I'm missing a great story?
Neither. I feel horribly guilty that, I should be covering it, that I should be there documenting what's going on. There's another, you know, you heard the top of the news hour today, another alleged chemical attack on civilians outside of Damascus. And, yeah, no, I'm not, I don't think, oh, phew, and I don't think, gosh, what a great story. I just think the hardest thing for me to confront as I do walk away from this life is that I'm leaving people behind, people I was committed to, stories that I was committed to telling, that somehow if there's some ego involved here, you know, you think if I'm not telling them, who will? Of course somebody else will tell it. But you know that when you were in it, you were telling it with everything you had, and that's not happening anymore.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, I think Jay mentioned this earlier, that you interviewed other correspondents to get their perspectives, people like Sebastian Younger and Christiane Amanpour, and you got advice, and sometimes the advice wasn't the same. They gave you conflicting advice. So was it helpful?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, each moment in the quest, as we went along through time, really kind of just helped me understand things better. I think the first correspondent I talked to was the BBC's Paul Wood. And, you know, he is this longtime war correspondent. You know, he's done, you know, Chechnya and the Balkans and the first Gulf Wars and, you know, of course, Iraq and Afghanistan and now Syria. And, you know, I think what I wanted to get from him, I was convinced at that moment, at that time during the quest, that it's okay for me to be covering this war in Syria because I'm not really a war correspondent. I'm not like those guys like Paul Wood, those crazy guys, those really insane people who always go to the front line. I'm not like that. I'm different. I was trying to comfort myself, right? And then after I talked to him, yeah, he was saying the same thing. You know, he was like, well, I'm not like the really, you know, crazy testosterone-driven, you know, guys. I'm really kind of trying to hang back. And I thought, uh-oh. You know, I need to listen to this because if that's the way he's justifying what he's doing, maybe I'm doing the same thing. So, I mean, it was just a great moment for me to kind of just sort of understand how, you know, I should think about things going forward. And he is also the first person who raised the idea of a letter. Mm-hmm. He, you know, talking to ex-military types, people who, you know, soldiers, when they go into battle, they prepare for the worst, right? They sit down, they write a letter to their family in case the worst thing could happen. They get their insurance in order. You know, everything is, they think about it, right? And he said that, you know, journalists, we don't think about it. You know, we purposely don't think about it, and that he was advised to sit down and write that letter. Paul has 5 children of his own, and I asked him, I said, well, how did you do it? Did you write the letter? He said, no, I can't do that. I can't, you know, if I did that, then I would, you know, come face to face with what this is all about, and I don't want to do that.
Yeah. So one of the things that you mentioned, what I found really fascinating in this whole documentary was the dopamine thing, the fact that some people have these higher levels of dopamine, and that as we age, the dopamine levels drop a little bit. And when you really look at this, you know, you look like Sebastian Junger had this conversation with you where he said, you know, I'm getting a little bit older now, and I would have done this in my 20s, but you know, now you think a little bit differently, and it's true. You make different decisions when you're in your 20s and 30s than you do once you get into your 40s and 50s.
Yeah, the researcher who has this theory is this Dr. Anthony Feinstein, who we talked to in the piece. And he, you know, he's the only person who's researched war correspondents. You know, it's not a huge, you know, sample of people, so there's not a lot of funding for that type of research. But he's, you know, over the course of maybe, well, more than a decade, sat down and surveyed and followed hundreds of war correspondents. And he really does believe that we have higher levels of dopamine. He's actually tested a set of twins. You know, one was a war correspondent and one was not, and found that the theory was true. And I think, yeah, he in other cases of dopamine, it is a sort of classic distribution. Mm-hmm. Men have higher levels than women, and yes, over time, these levels drop. And so his theory is that means that as your levels drop, then you don't seek the adventurous lifestyle as much anymore. And it does hold true. I mean, his findings are that the war correspondents who stick with this the longest, the kind of longest they'll do is about 15 years. Mm. And then close to your kind of your 50s, that's when you start to say, maybe it's time to get out.
We're talking with Kelly McEvers and Jay Allison about the radio documentary Diary of a Bad Year, A War Correspondent's Dilemma. Our toll-free number, if you have a question, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org.
Hey, Kelly, I'm interested to know in the, you know, since the piece came out, you know, I mean, one thing I know I was worried about, like, people feel, I think, in some way free to make judgments about mothers. And that in my documentary work in the past, whenever there's been a situation where there's a question of whether a mother has been a good mother or not, and there's been an internet discussion, it's like no holds barred. Everyone gets to criticize the mom. And you set yourself up in this piece for the possibility of that critique, and I think fundamentally in a different way than, say, Paul Wood or John Lee Anderson as dads doing this work. And I wonder if post piece or at any point in this you've felt that judgment.
A little bit. I mean, I think I haven't gotten the really harsh criticism that I'm sure is to come. But what a lot of people do is say things like, well, you know, once I realized that you had a child, of course you're going to quit. You know, it's like, put yourself out there and people, you know, because the piece, we leave it pretty ambiguous as to what I'm going to do, you know, whether I'm going to continue doing this work. Because at the time that we finished this piece, I was still doing the work and I didn't really know how I was going to go forward. And so I think people just, you know, say, well, you got to decide, you know, to leave because you have a family. And I really hope that that's not the takeaway from this. I really hope that, you know, this the conclusion is that you can't be a war correspondent and a mother. I don't think that's true. I mean, I really do. I do know people who are still doing it and who are trying to figure out, you know, the limits of what kind of work they can do and still, you know, be good parents. It's also really frustrating. You know, I've got a dear friend, photographer Lindsay Adario. She's a fantastic conflict photographer, and she's recently had a child, and she says that, you know, it's always the first question that's asked of her when she's sitting on a panel, you know, how do you do this work, and you have a child, and she'll say, you know, I'm really happy to answer that question, but I need to know why you don't ask my male, that's not the first question you ask my male colleagues. You know, it's always the first question that gets asked of us as women, and, you know, how do you do this with children, when men have been doing it with children for generations. So I think there's a whole lot of, you know, I think there's a lot of room for people to judge, but I hope they think about it.
Yeah. I want to ask you about fear. I get the sense that you weren't so much fearful about dying while covering Middles, but rather fearful about how your death would impact those you love. True?
I think I came to that later after talking especially to Sebastian Younger and after going to so many funerals, you know, I mean, just seeing the grief on people's faces and knowing that you, by your own actions, could cause that kind of grief, definitely. But it really wasn't until I talked to Sebastian Younger and talked to him about losing his friend and collaborator, Tim Hetherington, cameraman and photojournalist who died in Libya. And the things that he said about it were just so moving and really made an impact on me. And he said things like, you're gambling with other people's grief. You know, when you die, that's it. You're done. You know, nothing happens to you. It's curtains. It's everybody else who suffers. I think Sebastian and their friends, you know, and the way, what they went through after losing Tim really made him think, how could I then go back and risk putting my own people through something like this? Right. And hearing him say that really, really had an effect on me.
Yeah. What about fear, though? When you were covering before that, when did you first get the sense of, wow, I'm in a really dangerous situation? Was it that moment when the French journalist, when you're talking, when you're pushing the stroller, and I mean, or was it before that?
In the moment, there isn't fear, and I don't really know how to explain that. I think, you know, the scientists would have their ideas about that. If there were, I wouldn't do it. You know, if I was, you know, the night before, if I was sitting in the hotel room, you know, unable to sleep because I was just so terrified, I wouldn't go. And there's been a couple times when there's been a situation that we were kind of lining it up and I just had a bad feeling about it and I just didn't go.
Right.
But there is, I don't know. It's just not part of the equation. When we're gearing up to go on a trip or on a assignment, you know, particularly into Syria, because that was really the conflict that I was covering the most. It's not fear. When the you know, it's getting to be dusk and the mortars start coming in, it's kind of the witching hour, and the security advisor looks at you and says, "Those are incoming. They're getting a little closer. We should probably go." You know, you say, "Okay," and you turn around, you get in the truck, and you go. You know, and then it's later, usually, that it kind of hits you like, oh, and you start to listen to the tape and you start hearing the booms. You think, wow, that, you know, it wasn't super close because we got out when we were supposed to get out. But, wow, you know, that
anything could happen, right?
Crazy.
Yeah.
I also think, as Kelly describes in this piece, that some people are wired to deal with these kinds of situations. And I remember asking my wife and I were talking about, you know, I wondered, worried a little bit that doing the process of this documentary might introduce doubt or like you second guessing her own instincts, Kelly, while you were in the field, and worried that, you know, you'd be thinking about the whether you should be there while you were there. And you said, no, actually, that stuff disappears. And I think Kelly's partly wired that way. I think that's one reason it's hard to make this decision. I thought of the analogy as like a like somebody who's got a great pitching arm. I mean, mm-hmm. Kelly's able to have real clarity under pressure,
right,
and able to think and even speak and has good instincts and remains safe. But she has to make the decision as a great pitcher. Yeah. Should I stop?
Right.
You know, I got this good arm. I'm good at this job. And should I quit it?
Because no story is worth dying for. You know, it's right. Like, I can keep pitching these great games, but then, you know, it's like, you know, there's still the chance that while you're pitching, a bomb could fall on your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's the thing, you know. It's like, it's so hard because it's not, there's no immediate reward for stopping. You know, it's kind of like, it's almost like quitting smoking or something. You know it's bad for you. And maybe you'll feel a little bit better if you quit, but it's something that you know could kill you in the future, so you have to stop it now. That's hard to do.
Right, but the smoking, but you're getting, like last year, Kelly won the Peabody Award, the mm-hmm. DuPont Columbia Award for reporting. I mean, it's as if smoking brought you great fame and recognition,
right.
too.
Funny, you're like, congratulations for continuing smoking. yeah, here's another 400,000 cigarettes,
right.
And trophies.
So your decision to leave the Middle East is still relatively recent, but it's sounding like you're not second-guessing that choice.
Oh, I second-guess it every day?
Oh, you do?
No, I mean, I know in my head that it's the right thing to do, but my heart, I can't remember which one. I know one of them thinks it's the right thing to do, knows it's the right thing. My head knows it's the right thing to do. My heart is broken. Like, I can't, for so many reasons, right? The guilt of leaving the story behind, my entire identity being wrapped up in this thing that I did. I'm the pitcher who's now not a pitcher anymore. So what am I? Knowing that things worked out pretty well when I was doing that job and I was wired to do it. So what could I possibly be wired to do now? I mean, these are all huge questions.
Right.
But yeah, no, it was the right thing to do. Yeah. And I know it.
So where do you go from here? What type of assignment are you hoping to get next from NPR?
It's all still in conversation, but I'm going to be based in the United States, still working for NPR as a national reporter. I'm going to be based in California, which may be a nice way to move out of the adrenaline-soaked lifestyle. I may be covering some things like guns and gun violence and use of drones domestically, so maybe I'll be able to, while I'm in kind of a calm place, be still covering things that I think are really important and also have a bit of a thrill to it. Yeah.
So in the radio documentary, as we mentioned, there was a lot of things that you have an hour and you had a lot of stories. Were there stories that you sort of wished you could have included that weren't in there?
In the documentary?
Yeah.
There were a lot of diaries that, not a lot, there were some diaries that we recorded that were just a little, you know, it's good to do these kinds of diaries. It's good to, as you go through your life, try to reflect. It doesn't always work. You know, I think sometimes you maybe don't have the perspective that you need. I think anytime a diary is pretty good if you can just step back maybe one step and try to just kind of look around, mm-hmm. even if you have like 30 seconds to do it. Sometimes you can't even step back that far. You know, you're just too in the moment. It's all very emotional and raw. And so I think there were a lot of times when, there was one in particular when after Marie Colvin died, the Times of London reporter who had covered every war, she died horribly in Syria on a story that we were all following like minute by minute. People who were injured in the attack like survived and were trapped inside this neighborhood in Syria and then had to be smuggled out by activists, and people died getting them out. And this one French journalist was strapped to a stretcher and at one point was left alone in a sewage tunnel, and somebody put a gun on her chest and said, you know, good luck, pray. Mm. I mean, just really intense images that we were following all the time from the story. And then I decided to go to Yemen. I had an assignment in Yemen, and I wanted to go do it. I didn't stay back for the funerals. I just kept working. And I sat in my hotel room and I started recording this long, kind of drawn out thing. And it wasn't, it just, you know, it was a moment in the quest that was an important moment, but I just didn't really have the, I was exhausted and I didn't really have much to say. I mean, it was just kind of recording what was happening, what was going through my mind at the moment, but it didn't really move the story along. Right. But ideally, yeah, I wish I could have told every single Arab Spring story that I had come across, because that's why I do this work. It was, it wasn't just any old story, you know, it was like one of the most important upheavals in the region ever, you know.
History,
like
tens
of millions of 22-year-olds taking to the streets to decide to overthrow their dictators. Exhilarating, amazing moment. And if I could impart anything, it would just be that how important and that story is and how lucky I was to cover it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sort of like, listen, this is like a journal. These radio diaries, like keeping a journal, only as you say, you've got a lot more raw emotion going there. So listening back, we've got about a minute left, Kelly. Listening back to the documentary, does it bring you back there? I mean, how do you, I mean, are you happy with the, obviously you're happy with the outcome.
There's always little things you want to change.
Yeah, yeah. It's never done, right?
There's parts that I really kind of don't listen to all the time. You know, it's pretty painful. I did it and I put it out there, but even still, hearing some of it is
hard.
It's just hard.
Yeah. And you do write that letter, and that letter is in the documentary. So for folks who want to hear that, we have two listening events coming up Sunday, August 25th at 7:30 at the Community Hall in Woods Hole, Monday, August 26th at 7:30 at the Preservation Hall in Wellfleet. We'll put link to Transom's website on our website. I think it's already up there, capeandislands.org. Again, no reserve seats. It's free. Get there early. Jay and Kelly will both be there to answer questions. Kelly, thanks so much for taking time to chat with us today. Oh, it was nice talking with you.
You're welcome.
And Jay Allison, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. See you soon, Kelly.
See ya.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.